Hi, new friends. Some of you are not new friends. I've known some of you a long time, but most of you are new friends, right, for me? So if we've not met yet, or if you've not introduced yourself yet, I'll be around. I would love to meet you. If you've only introduced yourself to me once so far, maybe do it again, because I've learned a lot of new names recently, and bear with me. So anyway, my name is Jake, and I'm the new teaching pastor here, which is so exciting. I know, right? So this morning, we're in Indiscriminate Joy, and it was funny, like, so I got assigned Joy, and then there were, like, some verses in the assignment that I should go to use for this morning. And do you ever have a moment when you feel like the Bible should make sense, and you're reading the verses, and it just makes no sense at all? We have to, like, imagine, like, play along. So you read the verse, or someone says it to you, and you're like, yes, amen. I have no idea. That was me, right? So I got this verse right here, which is from James chapter 1, verse 2. And this is what I had assigned for this morning. And it said this. It said, "Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy." And I'm like, well, okay, that sounds like fun. Let's do that for like 30 minutes. No, like, what does that even mean, right? Like, I can't even, like, wrap my mind around how to explain that in a meaningful way at first. And then I looked at other verses, so I read every verse in the entire Bible that said the word joy or rejoice, and then this one came up from Proverbs 17:22, a cheerful heart, which is there in the original language is joy, a joy. So a person with joy is good medicine, but a broken spirit saps a person's strength. And so you're like, all right, so if I have joy, it's a good medicine for my heart that's already joyful, but I don't really need medicine then. But if I've got a broken spirit, my strength is going to go too. Like this, okay, that's not really helpful. Where does joy come from? So you either have joy or you don't. Okay, well, let's keep reading. Here's this one, which is super helpful. Always be joyful? Like, what? Like, okay, this is from a guy named Paul, and Paul wrote this in 1 Thessalonians, and he doesn't tell us how. He just says, always be joyful. Are you joyful? You're like, thank you, Paul. I don't really know now how to add joy, but I'll be joyful all the time. That's super easy. Good times and bad, joyful. You know, I'm sick. My kids are sick. Joyful. Okay. Yes, we can do this. Thank you, Paul. And so I was working through these passages about joy, and I came across this one where at the beginning of the passage, the people in the passage they're literally hiding behind locked doors. They are cowering. They are afraid. They are depressed. Jesus says something to them. And at the end of the story, their lives are marked by a joy that is inexplicable, isn't inexpressible. It is eternal. It never goes away. So much so that later on, they'll be called upon to lose their life for their faith, and they do so joyfully. And you're like, okay, so here, they're afraid, they're depressed, they're behind a locked door, they're just trying to hope no one notices they're there, and here, they're walking through the streets praising Jesus in a way that their joy can't be taken from them. What happens in between? Like, what changes for them in between this moment and this moment? Because these moments are like 10 verses apart. So what do these 10 verses say? What can we get from them? And by the way, this right here is not solely important because it tells stories of what happened hundreds of years ago. These stories are important because these same truths and then happen to all of us on a daily, weekly, monthly, minute-by-minute way. And so the things that happen here, they're not significant just because they happen to them. It's because the same things can happen in and through and for us today. They are not just past tense. They are present tense and future tense. And so we're going to look at that passage today. It's in Luke chapter 24. And I invite you, if you have a Bible, to turn there or on your phone if you want to get that out. It'll be here on the screen. But if you want to follow along, you want to make notes, we're in Luke chapter 24. In the beginning of this passage, it goes this way. In verse 36, it says this. And just as they were telling about it, okay, stop right there. There's already some stuff we got to explain. Just as they. So what happened here is these people, Jesus has just died on the cross. And these people had invested their lives into following Jesus. They were walking away from their lives. They're walking away from their relationships. And as Jesus moved about to different towns, these people were following him. And they're like, yes, this Jesus guy, he's going to change the world. He's going to start a movement. There's a whole new thing happening, and we're going to be part of it. Let's go, Jesus. And then Jesus dies. And they feel like, wait a second. I thought you were going to change the world. What do we do now? And so these people who were following him, many of them just went back to their daily lives. And so these people, in the they it's referring to, is two particular people. They had left Jerusalem, and they were walking to Emmaus, their hometown. And it's kind of like kicking rocks as they go, because they've told their friends and their family, we're leaving our lives, and we're doing the Jesus thing. We're all about it. Let's go. And then he dies, and they're like trying to figure out, all right, well, when I get home, what am I going to say to my friends? What am I going to say to my family? Like, how are we going to explain this? I thought we were part of something. And right then, as they're walking down the street, Jesus appears to them, but because in his new body, they don't recognize him right away. And so he walked with them for a while. He eats a meal with them. He talks to them about himself, about what the Old Testament says about him. And then before he disappears, they realize who he is. And then just like that, Jesus disappears. And they're like, oh my goodness, that was Jesus. He's not dead. And so these two people, they go sprinting back from Emmaus back to Jerusalem. It's 7 miles. And so they come to where they know the disciples are, and they've been sprinting, and the door is locked because they're all afraid behind this door. And they're like, guys, you're not going to believe what we just saw on the road to Emmaus. And this is what we pick up. And just as they were telling about it, Jesus himself was suddenly standing there among them. Peace be with you, he said. This is kind of funny to me, because this would be like me if, like, I've been out with friends or playing basketball, and I go home, and see, you know, so my wife is home, and maybe she's watching TV, or she's like reading a book in bed, and she thinks she's alone in the house, the kids are sleeping, and I like jump into the room like, I'm home, don't be surprised. Right? She's like, why would you do that to me? That's not funny. Right? But what happened here is, like, they're like in this room, the door is locked, they're huddled, these two guys have ran back, and they're like, guys, you're not going to believe what just happened. And right, Jesus is like, peace be to you. They're like, what just happened? Right? And what's funny is actually C.S. Lewis, when he's talking about this, he says that it's like an actor in a play who, in the back of the stage, there's like folds in the curtain. And just as an actor can get his way in and off stage easily by going through a fold in the curtain, Jesus, in his new glorified body, can go through the folds of like the space-time continuum, like quantum physics stuff. And he's like, this is what Jesus was doing. So he just like appears there. He's like, hey, peace be to you. And they're like, oh my goodness, what? Don't do that, Jesus. We'll keep reading. But the whole group was startled and frightened, like as you are. You know, someone just appears in your midst behind a locked door, thinking they were seeing a ghost. Jesus is like, why are you frightened? Come on, Jesus. You know why they're frightened. Like, don't even play it off like you didn't do that on purpose. He asked, why are your hearts filled with doubt? Which is a very different question. Look at my hands. Look at my feet. You can see that it's really me. Touch me and make sure that I am not a ghost, because ghosts don't have bodies. And you see that I do. As he spoke, he showed them his hands and his feet. And so he appears to them, and this is the first time they've seen him, and he says, guys, we had our fun, but it's really me. It's really me. Like, look at the holes in my hands. Look at the holes in my feet. I am back. It is really me. And actually, the holes in Jesus' hands and the holes in Jesus' feet are the only man-made things that have ever been, that are, or ever will be in heaven. He's like, "This, it's me. Guys, I am really back." And he goes on. As he spoke, he showed his hands and his feet. Still, they stood there in disbelief, filled with joy and with wonder, as you do. And in this moment, what you have is you have Jesus. He has just conquered death. He has gone to the afterlife and come back. He has died for sins, and he has come back with a message of hope and joy for these people, and he is now ready to give it to them in its full glory. And he says, "Do you have anything here to eat?" That was funny in first service. I don't know where you guys are at. Okay. And it was funny. I love this because look what he says. He says, they gave him a piece of broiled fish and he ate it as they watched. And so it's so funny. I picture them be like, yeah, Jesus, here's some fish. And he's eating it. And he's eating it. And they're like looking at him like, and he's eating his fish. And it's funny because they don't say that they're talking at all. They're just like watching him as he's eating. Like, yeah, it's really him. Look at the holes in his hands. Yeah, that's really him. And then he said, after he finished his fish, probably washed it down, when I was with you before, I told you that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures. I love this because this happens to me all the time. This happened to me just this week in regards to this passage, where I was reading this passage and my mind was opened to what God was saying to us through it. Like, I've read this passage 100 times before and never seen it the way that we're talking about it here today now. But this is what happens. Like, when you read the word, like, even if you read this passage 100 times, God will come to you and he'll speak to you and he'll open your mind this exact same way to what he has for you from his word in that moment. And he says, guys, you don't understand. Like, he says, the Psalms and the prophets, this part back here, like this, when it says these things, what's going to happen, this is about me. And later on, it says this, and this was about me. And later on, it says this, and this is about me. And this is what he's doing. This is what he's opening their minds with. And he said in verse 46, yes, it was written long ago that the Messiah would suffer and die and rise from the dead on the third day. It was also written as this message would be proclaimed in the authority of his name to all the nations, beginning in Jerusalem. There is forgiveness of sins for all who repent. You are witnesses of all these things. He goes on through this passage, and he's saying, guys, you don't understand. Like, all of human history, every recorded incident, like, everything you have in your scriptures, this points to me. Like, this person said this happened. They were told you I would come. They told you I would suffer. They told you I would die and I would come back, and this is what's happened. Actually, in the book of Mark, it clearly says that Jesus told them he was going to be taken, he was going to suffer, he was going to die, he's going to come back. But somehow, when he said this to them, they just didn't get it. The wires didn't connect somehow. But in this moment, he's like, guys, you've missed the point. Like, I told you this was going to happen. I've come to accomplish a certain work, and I am now accomplishing that. And this passage right here, I love this. It says, you are witnesses of these things. Like, being a witness to something is different than knowing about it. Like, I can describe to you what it looked like when the first astronaut stepped off that, you know, lunar lander onto the moon. Because I've seen it before. I've seen pictures of it. I've seen videos of it. I can't tell you what it felt like if you watched that live and you were so proud of this accomplishment, your country. I can't tell you what that felt like. Like, I can tell you what the soldiers, you know, storming Normandy looked like. You know, the boats, they backed up to the beach, and that door came down, and they were in rows, and they came out, and there was gunfire raining down on them. I can tell you what it was like. I can't tell you what that felt like, to have those be your countrymen fighting for freedom. Because I didn't witness those things. I can tell you what it felt like to see the planes crash into the buildings on 9/11. Like, that I remember. I know at that time I was working at a sneaker store in the mall, paying for college and going, like, paying my way through college, you know, all kinds of jobs. That's a whole other story for a whole other day. I had so many jobs. But that was just one of them. And I remember the manager brought the TV from the back and put it on, like, the checkout counter, and we were watching, and, like, about 5 minutes after service started, a second plane went into the, and we looked at each other in disbelief, like, oh my goodness, this was on purpose. And the way that we felt powerless and confused, and we knew what, but we didn't know why, like, I witnessed that. And so that, for me, carries a whole other weight and I can explain it in a different way to you, a way that felt. Like what he's saying here, he's saying, you guys are witnesses. You guys have seen this. You've seen what happened. You've not only, like, you're not going to hear stories about me. You saw me heal people. You saw me love those other people didn't love. You saw me call children. You saw me. This is what you saw me do. Like, you are witnesses to this. And what I love about this is he's not like, go and convince people. Go and deride people. Go and make people feel like they, he just says, go and tell people what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've experienced, what you have witnessed. I mean, in my own life, I can tell you stories about who I was before Jesus and the way that I pursued satisfaction in ways that was never going to leave me satisfied. And the way that today, like, I live with hope and joy and peace and how that only could have come from Jesus. And this is not like a sales pitch. It's not like four spiritual laws. I'm not knocking on doors being like, if you die today, where would you go? I can't be like, Jesus came in and fundamentally changed me. In a world where people think that people don't change, I stand before you changed. That's not sales pitch. That's just honestly being a witness of what Jesus has done. This is what he calls us to do here. He says, you are witnesses of these things that I've come to accomplish. And then in verse 49, he says, and now I will send the Holy Spirit just as my Father promised. But stay here in the city until the Holy Spirit comes and fills you with power from heaven. In verse 50, then Jesus led them to Bethany, and lifting his hands to heaven, he blessed them. It's actually a benediction. I try and do this in my sermons, but basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to, benedict means good, diction means speech. You're trying to speak good, speak life, speak truth over someone as you leave them at the close of a sermon. Know this is true about you. This is what he does. He kind of gives them a benediction for their lives. As he was blessing them, he lifted them up and was taken to heaven. I think that Jesus chose to like ascend to heaven as opposed to go through a fold because he wanted them to know that there's closure here. There's some finality here. Like, I am leaving you. You are on your own. This is yours. Here's your ball. Take it and run with it. So they worshiped him and then returned to Jerusalem filled with great joy. And they spent all their time in the temple praising God. What's fascinating about this is as the story begins, they are without Jesus, behind a locked door, or going back to their old lives, completely depressed, without hope, just sort of consoling each other. As the story ends, they still do not have Jesus. They don't get to walk with him anymore. He's gone. But they have this joy that is defining them. That they've gone into the temple, and it says they're praising him continuously, surrounded by the exact people that just put Jesus to death. So here, they're terrified, and they're afraid, and they don't have Jesus. And here, there is joy unspeakable, and it's going to mark them for the rest of their lives. And you're like, well, what just happened? What did I just see? What Jesus did is he gave them some context. He says, guys, this story didn't start with you. And it didn't end the day I died. Like, this is a larger story that is happening. Of before I came, you were told these things. I came and accomplished them, and now you are going to be given power, and you go and continue the story. You were made for eternity. Ecclesiastes says it this way. It says, so God has made everything beautiful for its own time. Those moments when you guys feel like life is terrible and things are cracking down around you and the bills you can't pay and the relationship is falling apart and your kid who you feel like you've raised the right way is walking away from faith, like in those moments, that is beautiful in its own time. He has planted eternity in human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. In your heart, you know it as I'm speaking that you were made for more. You were made with eternity planted in your heart. And these day-to-day, in and out, up and down, frustrations and struggles and triumphs and victories, they are so short. And you were made for eternity. Let me say this another way. Let's say, theoretically, this rope, which by the way is tethered to the cross, it wasn't intentional, but it works. So, this rope represents eternity. All right? Hi. He said hi to me. I don't want to be rude. Okay, this is all of eternity, right? And it goes this way, and it's actually 100 feet long. It's not actually eternal, but bear with me. Let's imagine. Okay, so imagine this represents all of eternity, right? And this is all of life, and this is goes on and on and on and on forever. And there's a start moment when you were born, but it goes on and on and on and on forever because you have eternity in your heart. You were made as eternal beings. At the beginning of this very, very long eternal time, there's this very small, short window, this little red area at the end of this rope. This represents your life here on earth. All of your struggles, all of your victories, your triumphs, your bills you can't pay, your new cars, that new exciting job, that relationship, your weddings, every moment of every day in your life is represented here. And what Jesus says to those people behind those locked doors, and what he says to us, and what he says to you today, you give me this part, and I'll give you the rest. See, we get so caught up in this part, don't we? Like, we put all of our eggs in this basket, and it's nothing. We love this little area here so much, don't we? Like, we love it. You know, we're so concerned with it. And he says, guys, you give me this, and I'll give you that. And this is what Jesus did. He says, there was story before, there's things I promised to accomplish, and I accomplished them so that you can have the rest of this. So you give me this. And the crazy thing is, like, if you see life through this lens, as things come and go, and as struggles happen, and bills you can't pay, and your child who you've thought you've raised the right way, like, they're kind of being frustrating, or they make a mistake, like, it's just such a small thing in comparison to the rest of this. Like, this, it's so infinitesimally small. He says, you just give me this. In a painful period, like in this scale here, if it's a couple years of pain, like it's a small little section here. And he's like, just wait for it. Honor me with this, because I want to give you this. There is eternity planted in your heart. You are fundamentally eternal beings. But we get so caught up here that we think this matters. And it doesn't. First Peter says it this way. You love him even though you have not seen him. Though you do not see him now, you trust him. And you rejoice with a glorious, inexpressible joy. If you live giving him this tiny red part, what he promises in response is while you're here, inexpressible joy. When stuff happens, joy. When you triumph, joy. When things don't make sense, joy. That first verse I read you of James 1, chapter 2, of count it all joy when you are experiencing all kinds of struggles. Now that makes sense, right? Now it's like, oh, that struggle is here, and it's painful, and it's hard. But he's doing something in me. Like, he is cultivating character and alignment with who he's called me to be in that moment. And because it's a small section of this also small area, and there's so much more for me to look forward to, it is joyful because he's doing something, and he's alive in my spirit. Then that James 1, 2 passage makes sense if we see our lives as this. I was reading Philippians the other day, and Paul, the same guy who wrote 1 Thessalonians, he's talking about how he would be happy dying. And if he's going to be alive, he's going to serve Jesus. But if he dies, that's good too, because you're going to go be with Jesus. And I realized I couldn't say that. I love my life here on earth. Like, I love this red part. I love living for this red part. My eyes get taken off of eternity, and I live for this red part all the time. Guys, I'm just being honest with you. Like, this is not like, look at me, I live for this. No. Like, this struggle, we're all going to have to keep each other encouraged and accountable for this stuff, because loving this seeps its way back into our heart all the time. Mine, I don't know about yours, where I love my kids, and I love my wife, and I love, I don't know, hanging out with friends. And these are good things. But not if they turn my heart solely and only to this area. Because we're called for so much more. We were created for so much more. You were created for so much more. So let's talk about our kids, for instance. I mean, my son, he's on this like very competitive basketball team, and I played basketball my whole life, and I still love it, and I love playing with him, and I love watching his games. But as he was trying out for this very competitive team a couple years ago, I was thinking, like, I was like, man, like sports, like they can be hard for people. Like they make them sort of be self-reliant, and if we are viewing him and his heart through the lens of eternity, it's all those practices, all those driving, all those games. Is this an eternal investment? And I was praying to Jesus. I was like, Jesus, like, only have him make this team if sports in his life is going to make him closer and more aligned with you, love you, and only if we can be light and hope to his teammates. Because I wanted that for him, but more than that, I wanted to view him in light of eternity. And how many times have you seen someone who raised their kids in church, and after their kids leave the home and they're empty nesters, they're like, well, we're just going to like stay home and drink coffee and sleep in on Sundays because the church has nothing for me. Like, I've already done my duty here. Like, I've already checked that box. And I don't really even blame them, because that means they went to a church that didn't tell them that this is so infinitesimally small and insignificant, but they're called to so much more. Like, if you raised your kids in church and you never heard that, that's not even your fault. But you were. You were created with eternity in your heart. And you know it. Like, when you are wasting your life deep in who you are, you can feel it. That your life and your worth and your calling, it's like slipping away from you. You know that you were created for eternity. The root of who you are. Man, I've only been here for 2 weeks. I've heard people say something a couple times. And if this is you, I don't, you're here today, so in this service, so. But it's like, oh, I feel like they're always nickel and diming me. And like, you know, there's boxes in the back, there's generosity boxes here, and like, oh my goodness, like constantly like asking, they talk about like, you know, putting money in the box, and then they're going to Mirador, people I've never even met before, you want me to care about that? Like, you want me to support that thing? And there's this thing over here, and the kids go on these trips, and there's all, it's always something. Like, it's expensive to go to church these days. Like, I can't even afford to go to church. Yeah, that's about what people responded in the first service too. They're like, he's talking about money. Right? But honestly, like, my wife and I, like, we've talked about this in the past couple of years. We're not generous people. Like, we weren't. Like, we made a conscious effort to become more generous. Like, we loved this part in regards to our money. We loved what our money could do for us. We loved buying stuff. We loved being selfish with it. Like, we just loved it. It was my money in this world, and I'm going to claim it. And the thing is, like, this is what happens. Inevitably, something that we hold dear, more dear than Jesus, it like wraps itself around this area, and we begin to love and crave this little small thing we call life, as if this is the sum total of who you are, as if you weren't born with eternity in your heart. And so we said that we had to have an honest conversation in our relationship. Like, well, we're not generous, so what can we do to break ourselves of a love for this? And so we begin to take steps as a family, you know, to support different things. You know, we began supporting a child in another country. We began supporting someone who's spending their summer on a mission trip. We support the community financially. And over time, like, we are being broken of our love of this. We are acknowledging the truth that is that joy is a byproduct of acknowledging our own eternality. If you do not experience joy, if you don't live with joy, you are not acknowledging the way that you are eternal. Joy is a byproduct of living with a larger picture in mind. Joy is a byproduct of not loving this. Because if you love this and hard times come, how can you possibly be joyful? You were created for more. Look at my notes real fast. I haven't looked yet. It's not easy. And this is something that us as a community, we're going to have to wrestle with for years to come. Like, we're not going to walk out of here and be marked by joyful. As it says in 1 Thessalonians, you know, always be joyful. Like, it's not going to happen overnight. This is not like, okay, from here on for the rest of your life, you're going to be joyful, because the love of this little life area, it like seeps into our heart, and we're going to have to sort of work on that and ask Jesus to come in and kind of save us from these, a love of this area. And it's just going to be a lifelong process of letting go of this space, letting go of this place, letting go of this life, and loving him more than our distractions here. But I wanted to give you an example of someone who eventually got to a place where they were joyful no matter what. This guy named Joseph Sun, he's right here. He looks kind of like a grandfatherly type, you know, like the kind of guy who all the kids would run to and he'd have candy for them at church or something, you know, like, I don't know. If you guys have that here, if not, we're taking applications for the church grandfather. I had one growing up. They're awesome. But this guy, he was Romanian, and he was a pastor in Romania in a time and a where it was very, very dangerous to be that, to be a pastor in Romania. And he had just been taken and beaten for the umpteenth time for being a pastor. And there was a new guard who was known to be vicious in front of him, and they were talking for the first time. This is from his autobiography. And he says this to this new guard. He says, "Sir, let me explain how I see this issue." This is Joseph speaking. "Your supreme weapon is killing me. My supreme weapon is dying. Here's how it works. You know that my sermons on tape have spread all over the country. And if you kill me, those sermons will be sprinkled with my blood. Everyone will know I died for my preaching. And everyone who has a tape will pick it up and say, I'd better listen again to what this man preached, because he really meant it. He sealed it with his life. So, sir, my sermons will speak 10 times louder than before. I will actually rejoice in the supreme victory if you kill me. Later, I found out from another officer who said, we know that Mr. Sun would love to be a martyr, but we are not foolish. I will not fulfill his wish." So he goes on to say, "I stopped to consider the meaning of that statement. I remembered how for many years I had been afraid of dying. I had kept a low profile because I wanted badly to live. I had wasted my life in inactivity, and now that I had placed my life on the altar and decided I was ready to die for the gospel, they were telling me they would not kill me. I could go wherever I wanted in the country and preach whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, knowing I was safe. As long as I tried to save my life, I was losing it. Now that I was willing to lose it, I found it forever. And I'm telling you, over time, as you walk with Jesus, he will disconnect you from this. Ask him to help you in your heart. Disconnect from this. And as you disconnect from the ins and outs of this life, your love of this temporal thing we call life, it will be filled with more and more inexpressible joy. If you try and save your life, you will lose it. If you try and lose your life for Jesus, your life will be filled with joy. This is why the Bible says, be ready always to give an answer for the hope that lies within you. It doesn't say, go around telling people about your hope. It says, live with a joy and a hope in such a way that people are like, what's different about you? Why are you so much different than anyone I've ever seen? It says, be ready to give an answer, because if you live in this way, people will look at you and say, you're different, you're weird, what's up? And you'll be like, I got Jesus, baby. And I have eternity in my heart. So I invite you today to look at life the way that Jesus calls us to. This is a short time. And he says, you give me this. And in the meantime, if you do, I'll give you joy. And I'll give you that. This is the invitation of Jesus today. This is what Jesus did for those people in that moment, and this is what Jesus is doing for you. He invites you to a life marked by joy, acknowledging your own eternality. Let me close in prayer. God, we are so moved by you. We do not deserve your love, and you offer it anyway. We don't deserve the way that you bring joy, and you bring hope, and you bring meaning. But you do it again and again, time and again. We so often take our eyes off of who you've made us to be and place them solely on the here and the now, and you just look at that and you invite us back into more of yourself. You never look at us in shame. You never look at us and try to induce guilt. You say, "That's you'll get it next time. Love me more than you love your stuff. Love me more than you love your life. Love me more than you love those kids." Like you put me at the center and I'll give you all of eternity. Time and time again. And it's in those moments with that reality that we can live in joy forever. Literally forever. And so this is not just for the people who hear, it's for me as well. It's for all of us. God, separate us from our own need to love the here and the now. Give us your perspective for life. Give us your perspective for this life, for our stuff, for our children, for our relationships, for our money. Give us your eternal perspective on these things and allow us to walk and live in indiscriminate joy. We do not deserve you, and you give us yourself anyway, and we will always and forever be grateful. We love you. Your name.